close, the infinitesimal and the infinite, smaller than the smallest. To God there is no zero. I still exist. But who disappears? Not a man with a belly laugh. Not a man whose hands, when he plays a piano, makes an octave look like an inch. The last time I saw my brother, leaning gigantically back in his plastic garden chair, he grinned and brushed unseen particles from his biceps, then lifted his face to scan the clouds fleeting west like an exodus across the Kurdish sky. He looked, in this moment, so much like a creature that exerts its own forces on the world, and not the other way around, that it seemed to me a ludicrous idea that should he fail to jot down his bedtimes and bingo winnings, he might disappear. But then he disappeared. When I'd been sitting another 25 minutes, I got up and asked one of the other officers if I might go to the bathroom. She was a young woman with a lavender hijab and a thick black mascara that gave her otherwise sympathetic eyes a spidery look. Skeptically, she fetched a male officer to accompany me. This man was several inches shorter than I and, for some reason, chose to follow a yard or so behind me as we walked, so that I felt as if I were taking a small child to the toilet rather than being chaperoned myself. Only when we passed an unmanned checkpoint did my minder quicken his pace. Of course, one would have to be very desperate indeed to try to jump passport control without a passport. And even if you were to slip through unapprehended, what then do you do, trapped in England without one?
Peddle contraband or pull pints in the hinterland until you die?
Mine had been taken from me in exchange for a half sheet of paper confirming my detainee status. This slip of paper I was now carrying into the men's room with two hands, as though it bore the instructions I needed to urinate and flush. Rather than wait outside, my minder followed me in and, having offered to hold my slip, stood by the sinks, jingling the coins in his pockets while I drained my bladder and then took my time soaping and rinsing and drying my hands. It was something to do. Checking my cell phone messages would have been another thing to do, but I didn't have a signal. When we'd returned to my seat, my minder nodded without a word and resumed his post by the line for EU nationals. In front of me, time and again, a passport was presented, fanned, examined, stamped, and returned, its integrity verified and its owner already turning his mind toward the logistics of baggage claim and onward travel. Whereas the woman who'd taken my passport remained nowhere to be seen. To access the AstroTurf Terrace, you had to squeeze through a narrow hallway of a room containing a single twin bed and an upright piano. The bed was Sammy's. The piano was there when we moved in. The space in between was so tight that my brother could reach up and trill the keyboard's topmost octave even when he was lying down. The piano had a plain boxy shape and was made of a dark wood that was nicked all over and turned reddish in the mid-morning sun. It was an old Wesser Brothers, revamped during the Second World War when the construction of new pianos could not meet the demand, inspiring manufacturers to rehabilitate used models with new arms, new legs, new keytops, and new scrolls. They also hid the tuning pins on top with a long mirrored casing designed to make the instrument look smaller than it was.
The mirror on ours had a diagonal crack across one corner, and much of its surface has become mottled with age. I think it was Saul Bellow who said that death is the dark backing a mirror needs if we are to see anything. What, then, does one make of so much darkness already showing through? I call it Sammy's piano, but technically it belonged to our landlords, Marty Fish and Max Fisher, who lived downstairs. Fisher played first violin for the New York Philharmonic. Fish played piano in a West Village piano bar popular with people who liked their show tunes, mangled with drunken sing-alongs. We Jafaris referred to these two men jointly as the Fishes, and Marty in the singular as Shabut, because his extraordinary ovoid shape reminded my brother of the carp Baghdadi fishermen used to butterfly and grill on the Tigris. Maxwell Fisher, on the other hand, was too unassailably debonair for a nickname. A Bavarian graduate of the Paris Conservatory, he was a devoutly trim man who took his early morning constitutionals in paisley cravats that on the pavements of Bay Ridge looked as exotic as if he'd wound an Indian cobra around his neck. Fisher had a soft, high voice and crisp German diction that lent all conversations with him an aura of the philosophical. We always knew when he was home, because instead of the muffled Sondheim and Hamlisch that signaled Shabud battling a funk, floating up came the virtuous strains of Elgar and Janisch, played if not on a cherished pair of hi-fi speakers, then on Fisher's Stradivarius, by Fisher himself. The violin he flossed and buffed as if it were a surgical instrument. He swept the communal foyer once a day, and on Saturdays vacuumed so protractedly that for half an hour afterward the silence rang in your ears. It became second nature for me to remove my shoes whenever entering the Fisher's apartment, long before I no longer had to be told to take them off on going into a mosque. But all this domestic pulchritude was Fisher's doing.
Left to himself, Shabut would have let the dust form drifts and ironing a pastel hillock on the bedroom floor.
The only thing Shabut cleaned voluntarily was his answer to Fisher's violin, a Macassar ebony Steinway that at nearly 7 feet long dwarfed the living room around it and was the reason old Wesser brothers had been relegated upstairs. Our mother's tendency to mythologize our childhoods would have you believe that Sammy, who had never touched a musical instrument before, sat down at that piano for the first time and was rolling up bagatelles by sundown. I don't think it was quite like this. A more accurate version surely begins with the fact that it has long confounded my parents, and me to a degree as well, and that is my brother did not like living in America. Almost from the beginning, he complained of missing Baghdadi friends and pointedly lagged behind in school, although he was no less clever than his classmates and had spoken English as well as Arabic since he was 3. At home, he became mopey and shiftless, getting off the sofa only for meals or to smoke marijuana in the basketball courts in the park with the Trinidadian girl who lived behind the synagogue on the next block. Then one afternoon, Shabut, who'd come upstairs to address a glitch in the plumbing, lingered over the Wesser brothers long enough to pluck out the opening measures of Bohemian Rhapsody, and Sammy got up from the sofa and asked him to do it again. Half an hour later, the drainpipe in the kitchen was still leaking, and Sammy and Shabut were sitting hip to hip at the piano, Sammy chewing his lip and Shabut humming corrections, rearranging Sammy's fingers and jabbing indignantly at the keyboard's sticky middle D. This is how one would find them nearly every Wednesday afternoon thereafter. In summer, silhouetted against the terrace, in winter with mugs of tea steaming up the mottled mirror. In theory, there was no practicing allowed after 10:30 at night, but often Sammy would wait until all was dark at the other end of the apartment and then resume his playing with one foot on the damper pedal and his head cocked so low to the keyboard you'd think his ear could vacuum up the sound. Of course, one can play a piano only so quietly, about as well as you can whisper a tune. But no one dared discourage my brother. He was unhappy, and my parents blamed themselves. At least when he was playing the piano, he was not shiftless. Nor was he ambitious in any conventional sense. He did not give recitals. He did not perform. For Sammy, the aim in playing was simply to play. To match finger to key, one after the other or in their cherry-like clusters, and to enjoy the result as one enjoys listening to a story unfold. In his tiny bedroom that was more a corridor than a destination, my brother hunched over his piano with something like the charged necessity that grips chain smokers or binge eaters or people who bounce their knees. Maybe it absorbed a nervous energy. Maybe it blunted a pain. I don't know. It could even seem wasteful the way he went through sheet music, rarely playing a piece more than twice in favor of moving on to another sonata, another concerto, another mazurka, nocturne, or waltz. As though their notes were part of an infinite current and Sammy the copper wire through which they wanted to flow. Of course, every now and again he would stumble over a difficult passage and back up to play it again, but this was rarer than you'd expect. And never, not once, I can't even imagine it, did he growl or drive his fist into the keys with impatience. I have always envied my brother his affair with that piano. You can tell when someone is unbedeviled by time. When I'd sat holding my half sheet of paper for a full 40 minutes more, I stood up and asked the woman in the lavender hijab whether I might be allowed to make a call. "Who's dealing with you?" I didn't catch her name. She has blonde hair, down to here. "Denise. Let me see if I can find her." My seat was still warm. I had some extracurricular reading on post-Keynesian price theory with me, but instead of opening it, I was watching the other arrivals as they reached the end of the metal maze. A man wearing a turban and a badge on a ribbon around his neck stood at the terminus and directed each new group or solitary traveler to a desk. People shuffled forward in suits and saris, stilettos and sweatpants, pushing strollers or carrying neck pillows or briefcases or teddy bears or shopping bags festooned with two-dimensional bows and holly. Sometimes, only one passport would be stamped. Other times, you heard two or three or four stamped in quick succession, like library books once upon a time.
and the overall rhythm of people advancing and stamping had a kind of prolonged regularity to it, like a jazz improvisation that, for all its deviations, never loses its beat. Then, a small, unaccompanied woman failed to move on. She had dark, shoulder-length hair and stood at the desk she'd been shunted to shyly, as though trying to become invisible. She nodded at everything the immigration officer said. She nodded even when it looked from the officer's face that maybe she had not understood the question. She did not have any luggage with her, only a small satin-embroidered purse that she held with both hands in front of her hips like a fig leaf. The officer frowned at her kindly, but also intently, as if he were trying to prop her up with his eyes. When the officer handed the girl a half sheet of paper like mine, the girl turned around to sit down and I saw that she was Chinese. Not 5 minutes later, her officer returned. It piqued me that this should happen so quickly, while my own officer took her time. To a second officer, the first officer said, "Tell her that you're here to translate." The translator tugged up her trousers and crouched down to speak to the girl in short twanging sounds that, to my ears, could have been the same language played backward. The girl nodded. "Tell her that she's not in trouble. We're just concerned about her welfare and need to ask her some additional questions before we can let her through." Again, the second officer spoke and the girl nodded. "What is the name of her school here in the UK?" The girl took a piece of paper out of her purse. Pointing, the first officer said, "Whose number is this?" "Her professor's." "Who is her professor?" "Professor Ken." "Professor Ken helped her arrange this visa?" "Yes." "But she doesn't know the name of Professor Ken's school?" "Ken's school." "How long is she planning on staying?" "6 months." "Does she have a return flight?" "No, but she'll buy one." "Where will she live?" "Professor Ken has a house." "Where?" "She doesn't know." "How much money does she have?" "Professor Ken has given her a scholarship." "Do her parents know she's here?" The girl nodded. "Does she have a phone number for them? A number we could call?" The girl produced a pink Nokia and showed it to the second officer, who wrote something down. "Tell her she's not in trouble. We're just concerned that she seems to be here without a place to stay and hardly any English skills." When the second officer had translated, the girl spoke at length for the first time, in a high-pitched rush that seemed to strain against panic. Then abruptly she stopped talking, and both officers looked uncertain as to whether she was done. "She says she's here to learn English," the second officer said. "Her family knows she's here. She got a scholarship from Professor Ken, who arranged the visa, and when she's collected her luggage, she's supposed to call this number, and Professor Ken will come and pick her up." The first officer frowned. "Tell her she's going to be waiting here just a little bit longer. Tell her she has nothing to worry about. Tell her she's not in trouble. It's just that we're concerned for her safety and need to make some general inquiries. We need to ensure she's in good hands." When the second officer had translated this, the girl sniffed. "Tell her she's not in trouble," the first officer said again, more kindly than before, but this time the girl, still sniffling, did not seem to hear. According to Calvin Coolidge, economy is the only method by which we prepare today to afford the improvements of tomorrow. Whatever else you think about Coolidge, the statement does seem more or less correct. And when I came across it for the first time shortly after starting graduate school, I thought, at last, I'm pursuing a profession befitting of my neuroses. This is because my mind is always turning over this question of how I'm going to feel later, based on what I'm doing now. Later in the day, later in the week, later in a life starting to look like a series of activities designed to make me feel good later, but not now. Knowing I'll feel good later makes me feel good enough now. Calvin Coolidge would approve, but according to my mother, there's another term for such supermodulated living, and it translates roughly into not being able to live like a dog. "You would be happier," she has been heard to say, "if you were more like your brother. Sammy lives in the moment, like a dog." For the record, my brother's name means high, lofty, or elevated. Not traits you'd readily associate with an animal that sniffs assholes and shits in plain sight. But I suppose my parents could not have predicted his canine spontaneity when they named him. Nor could they have known that the one they named Making a Home would grow up to have nothing in his refrigerator but 7 packets of soy sauce and an expired carton of eggs. In December of 1988, on the flight to Baghdad from Amman,
our parents forbade us from bringing up two subjects with our Iraqi interlocutors. Saddam Hussein and Sammy's piano. Never mind the 10 years of music lessons he'd taken from our homosexual landlord downstairs. At any rate, what most of my aunts and uncles wanted to discuss around my grandmother's kitchen table was the exotic extent of my Americanness. My Brooklyn accent, my Don Mattingly jersey, my pristine navy blue passport, and my embossed City of New York certification of birth. This last, of course, meant that I would be entitled to run for the American presidency one day. And while Sammy and I practiced juggling oranges with our cousins in the back garden, our elder relatives discussed this prospect with all the sobriety and momentousness of a G7 convention.
President Jafari. President Amir Ala Jafari. President Barack Hussein Obama.
I suppose one does not sound so very much more unlikely than the other. And yet, at 12 years old, I knew perfectly well that my parents' truer hope was that I too would do as they had done, and as my brother looked all but certain to do, and that was to become a doctor. A doctor is respected. A doctor is never out of work. Being a doctor opens doors. Economics my parents also consider respectable, but reliable? No. Ungraspable, my father's word. And even if one is more likely to ascend to the office of the presidency with a doctorate in economics than with a medical degree under his belt, my mother no longer mentions my eligibility these days. Maybe because she thinks the position does not befit a man largely incapable of escaping, except infrequently and accidentally, a consciousness trained on how every action undertaken is later going to make him feel. On Christmas, my Uncle Zaid and Aunt Alia came over with their four girls, who, lined up with their matching red hijabs, looked like a set of Russian dolls. 10 years earlier, their oldest, Rania, had held my diapered bottom in her lap and fed me one by one the ruby-like seeds of a pomegranate. She was older now, too pretty to look at directly, as one strains to look at the sun. On entering the kitchen, she went straight over to my brother and said,
Bi Amrika el Dunya Makluba.
Amrika is America. Makluba means upside down. And for this reason is also the name of a meat and rice dish that's baked in a pan and upended before serving. El Dunya Makluba means the world is upside down, an expression typically employed to describe people or places in a state of high excitement verging on mayhem. My brother laughed.
America on Christmas indeed. The world is upside down in America today.
What it brought to mind was one of those illustrations of world peace or harmony in spite of diversity. People with different colored faces holding hands like a chain of paper dolls stretched all the way around the world. Only in this instance, for once, the ones standing on America were the ones with the blood going to their heads. According to modern cartography, the antipode of my bedroom in Bay Ridge is a wave in the Indian Ocean, several miles southwest of Perth. But to a 12-year-old boy traveling abroad for the first time since he was a toddler, it might as well have been my bedroom in my grandparents' house in Hai El Jihad. I shared this room with three other cousins, whose parents had immigrated soon after their children were born. My father and Zaid were the oldest of 12 siblings, five of whom had left Iraq. Four remain, and three are dead. To listen to us boys as we lay in our bunks and complained about what we were missing back home was to think we were high-rolling lady killers serving 10 years our time. Ali and Saba, who lived in London, worried that their girlfriends would be usurped by men of legal driving age. Hussein, who lived in Columbus, was tormented over not being able to watch the Bengals play the 49ers in the Super Bowl, the result of which it would take us 10 days to learn. The Bengals lost. Today, you could stand in Fairdos Square and Google how the Bengals or the 49ers or the Red Sox or the Yankees or Manchester United or Mongolia Blue Wolves are doing right now. You could check out the temperature in Bay Ridge or Helsinki. You could find out when the tide will next be high in Santa Monica or Swaziland, or when the sun is due to set on Poggibonsi. There's always something happening, always something to be apprised of, never enough hours to feel sufficiently apprised. Certainly not if you are also nursing some nobler ambition. 20 years ago, however, in incommunicado Baghdad, time crept. I once heard a filmmaker say that in order to be truly creative, a person must be in possession of four things. Irony, melancholy, a sense of competition, and boredom. Whatever my deficiencies in the first three areas, I enjoyed such an abundance of the fourth that winter in Iraq that by the time we returned to New York, I had eked out my first and only poetry cycle. What else did I do? Spent hours upon hours juggling, which is to say dropping and picking up oranges in the backyard until I could no longer see them for the dusk. With my father and Zaid, I visited our relatives buried outside Najaf, and in the evening sat at the kitchen table, doodling in the margins of my homework. An inordinate amount of homework to make up for all the school I was missing, while my grandfather sat beside me, slowly rotating the pages of Al-Thawla. One evening, he looked over to see me adding a few details to a sinking warship.
"If you're going to be president of Amrika," he said, "you're going to have to do better than that."
With Sammy, I went to Zaura Park Zoo, where we tossed lit cigarettes to the chimpanzees and laughed at how human they looked when they smoked them. My brother had just graduated from Georgetown, where he'd been president of the Pre-Med Society and wrote a thesis on curbing tuberculosis in homeless populations. Somewhat contrary to this foundation, within a week of our arrival in Baghdad, he'd taken up, without any apparent compunction, the unofficial Iraqi national pastime of chain-smoking Marlboro Reds. A grandmother's roof had a distant view of the Tigris, and as he stood beside me up there, smoking and squinting toward Karada, my brother told me about how, on hot summer nights in the 70s, he and our parents would carry mattresses up to the roof in order to sleep in the relief of the river's breeze. It was not warm the night I heard this story, nor was there a mattress to hand, only an old Afghan blanket that Sammy had slung over his shoulder and carried up from the den. Still, in the moonlight, my brother lay down, patted the space beside him, and as we stared up at the stars together, Sammy predicted it would not be long before Iraq was glorious again. Pothole-free roads, glittering suspension bridges, five-star hotels, the ruins of Babylon, Hatra, and the Stelae of Nineveh all restored to their majesty and made visitable without supervision of armed guards. Instead of Hawaii, honeymooners would fly to Basra. Instead of gelato, they would swoon over dolma and chai. Schoolchildren would pose in front of the Ur Ziggurat. Backpackers would send home postcards of Al-Askari. Retirees would bubble wrap into their luggage jars of honey from Yusufia. Baghdad would host the Olympics. The Lions of Mesopotamia would win the World Cup. Just you wait, little brother. Just you wait. Forget Disney World. Forget Venice. Forget Big Ben pencil sharpeners and overpriced cafe cremes on the Seine. It's Iraq's turn now. Iraq is done with wars, and people are going to come from all over to see its beauty and history for themselves. I once fell in love with a girl whose parents had divorced when she was very young. She told me about how, having learned from her mother what was going to happen, that the two of them and her baby sister were going to move into a new house across town, she became preoccupied with questions of what you can and cannot take with you when you move. Repeatedly, she went back to her mother for clarification. "Can I take my desk? My dog? My books? My crayons?" Years later, a psychologist would suggest that perhaps this fixation on what she could and could not take had arisen because she had already been told what they were not going to take. Her father. And if not a father, what should a little girl be allowed to hold on to? At the time, I felt ill-equipped to judge this hypothesis, but I did have my doubts about the validity of the memory itself. I asked Maddie whether it wasn't possible that she did not, in fact, recall the actual moment at which she had asked these questions, but rather whether her mother had told her the story so many times that it had retroactively acquired the status of a memory in her mind. Eventually, Maddie would concede that maybe the memory had, in fact, been born in her mother's telling. But she also said that she did not see what difference this made. If either way, it was a part of her story and she was not going out of her way to delude herself. She also remarked that it surprised her not to remember anything at all about the actual moment of separation from her father, despite it being one of her life's most critical developments. I asked how old she'd been at the time. 4, she said. 4, going on 5. Being under the impression that my own superior memory would never have excised such an event, I suggested that maybe Maddie was one of those people who don't remember anything from before they were, say, 6. I was very arrogant then. It would not surprise me to learn that when Maddie thinks of our time together, she does not remember loving me at all. Home from graduate school years later, I was having dinner with my parents in Bay Ridge when my father started talking about Schiphol, the airport just outside Amsterdam. Specifically, he was telling us about how, in Dutch, Schiphol means ship grave, because the airport had been built on land reclaimed from a shallow lake notorious for its many shipwrecks. "Dad," I said, "I already know this. You told me this when I was 12. You told me this when we were there, waiting for our flight to Amman." "That can't be right," he said. I only just read it this afternoon. Well, maybe you'd forgotten that you knew it, I said, because I can clearly remember sitting in the terminal, waiting to board, and looking out across the tarmac and thinking about the boats buried underneath. I remember picturing ships like skeletons, with bones like human bones, femurs and fibulae and giant rib cages for hulls. Huh, said my father. A moment later I added, or maybe it was Sammy. Maybe Sammy told me about the ships. At this point my mother held up a hand and said that this was the first she had ever heard about any ship grave. She also reminded us that that December of 1988, when I was 12, was the same December in which Sammy was recovering from mono and spent our layovers en route to Baghdad, slumped over our luggage or prostrate on a bench. Well, I said, he still could have said it to me. Or maybe he said it on the way back, when we passed through Schiphol again on the way home. Now my mother gave me a wounded look that a moment later softened into something like pity for me and my selective amnesia. Amir, she said quietly, your brother was not with us on the way home. As it goes, Denise's hair is more of a walnut color. She's also wider in the hips than I'd remembered, and in the crook of one elbow was carrying a manila folder so thick you would have thought I was Elger Hiss. I made a show of sitting up straighter, bookmarking the book I hadn't been reading, and raising my eyebrows in the manner of someone cooperative yet bemused. I was bemused, but my inclinations toward cooperation were waning. Denise sat down beside me and spoke quietly, discreetly, while I detected in her eyes a certain frisson, as though she'd been waiting a long time for a case like mine. Maybe I was even her first. Mr. Jafari, apart from your American passport, do you have any other nationality passport or identification document? Yes. You do? Yes. What? An Iraqi passport. Again, the frisson. How is that? My parents are Iraqi. They applied for one after I was born. Do you have it with you? I bent down to unzip my backpack. When I pulled it out and handed it to her, Denise began turning the pages of my second passport slowly, by the edges, like you handle a postcard whose ink isn't yet dry. When do you use this? Very rarely. But under what circumstances? Whenever I enter or leave Iraq. And does that give you an advantage? What sort of advantage? You tell me. If you had two passports, I said evenly, wouldn't you use your British one whenever entering or leaving the UK? Of course, said Denise. That's the law. But I don't know what the law is in Iraq, now do I? I didn't mean to, but I smiled. And faintly, Denise flinched. Then, still holding my second passport, which is to say, the only passport I had left, she nodded slowly, comprehendingly, tapped it lightly once on her knee, and stood up and walked away. Sometimes I think I remember the pomegranate. Its tannic sweetness, the sticky juice running down my chin. But to this day, there's an instant Polaroid of the moment taped to our refrigerator in Bay Ridge. And again, I cannot be certain whether if there were no photograph, there would be no memory. In both, Rania is wearing a blue hijab. The way she's holding me, the way the fabric flows down over her shoulders and around my diaper and into her blouse, make it look like we are posing for a maestra. How many times does a boy open the refrigerator of his youth? 6,000 times? 9,000? Whatever the number, it was plenty to make an indelible impression. Every glass of milk, every swig of juice, every leftover slice of makhluba. And of course, my brother would have seen it every day for a good many formative years as well. The following December, my parents returned to Baghdad on their own. I stayed in Bay Ridge under the pretense that I did not want to miss junior varsity swimming tryouts, and was supervised by the parents of a classmate whose bedroom contained a lumpy trundle bed and a life-sized poster of Paulina Poroskova. I did not try out for the swim team, and when my parents returned at the end of January, they did not ask me how it had gone. They were preoccupied with the news that my brother wanted to marry Rania. He had also mentioned wanting to move to Najaf in order to study at an Islamic seminary there. When my father told me that, my mother covered her face with her hands. That Rania was our first cousin was not inherently the problem. Nor was the problem the heightened risk of offspring with a recessive gene disorder, although my parents had long made clear their opinion that clan fidelity is not worth burdening a child with something that might be avoided with a little genetic testing. The problem was that marrying Rania clearly indicated a broader intention to resettle in Iraq, whose values my brother had claimed to prefer over the rather less decorous ones on display in America. And yet, to be valid in Sammy's own mind, to accord with the more decorous values he claimed to prefer, the engagement required our parents' blessing. Rania's parents had already given theirs. They had even waived a dowry. But my mother and father were not so ready to sanction Sammy's rejection of the life they had strenuously uprooted themselves to grant us. What they decided was that their blessing would be contingent on Sammy and Rania marrying in New York and Sammy earning his graduate degree from an American university. He could study religion instead of medicine if he wanted. He could return to Iraq afterward if he wanted. But if he wanted to marry Rania with full parental endorsement, these were the conditions, and my brother agreed. We expected him to arrive in New York with Rania and our grandmother the following July. At the airport, however, we found my father's mother waiting outside the arrival's gate, alone. She had flown with them as far as Amman, where they were to catch a connecting flight to Cairo, but the Jordanian authorities had stopped Sammy and Rania on the basis that they did not believe they were going to America in order to get married. "What is your real reason for traveling to America?" "To get married," said Sammy. "That is a lie," said the authorities. "You would not be traveling together if you were not already married." "No," Sammy insisted. "Really, we are not yet married. We are going to be married in the States where my parents live and are expecting us." "Then you must be a whore," one of the officers said to Rania. "A slut. How else do you explain this traveling with a man who is not your husband?" At this, Rania fainted, which the officers gladly took as confirmation of their suspicions. As a result, Sammy and Rania returned to Iraq while our grandmother flew alone onto Cairo, London, and New York. She was meant to visit us for 7 weeks, my grandfather having stayed behind in order to recuperate from a hip operation. But then Iraq invaded Kuwait, and 7 weeks became 7 months. My grandmother was not the only one displaced. I had moved into Sammy's bedroom and given her mine. Owing to my mother's concern that Sammy's room was too drafty, by which I think she meant contains a piano, which my grandmother had been raised to regard as a frivolous invention, although apparently not so frivolous as to be resisted when she thought no one else was home. From time to time, Zaid would call to tell us that everyone was fine. Jido's hip was getting better, Alia was taking care of the fruit trees. There was no mention of air raid sirens or cruise missiles whistling across the sky. For life in a panopticon had long conditioned Iraqis to believe that the walls have ears and the windows have eyes. And you never know when the watchmen are off duty, so you assume they are always on. Less convincingly, the panopticon was also blamed for my brother's long silences. Sammy had never been a letter writer, so I had no right to expect in-kind replies to the loquacious novellas I typed up and mailed off to him roughly once a month. However, my brother did not even acknowledge those letters. Not in his breezy greetings from Baghdad postcards, and not when he called, which I seem to remember him doing only twice. The first time was on New Year's Eve, when our parents would have been back in Iraq themselves had there not been a war on. Ostensibly, the call was to wish us a happy 1991, inshallah. But then Sammy went on to say that he and Rania were not going to be married after all. He did not sound disappointed. Instead, he sounded perfectly sanguine. Sanguine and maybe even a little relieved. Rania was going to study art history in Paris, and he too had reconsidered his plans to move to Najaf, and was looking into applying to Baghdad Medical School instead. "What's wrong with the medical schools in America?" I asked when it was my turn on the phone. "Nothing," Sammy said blithely. "What's wrong with the medical schools in Iraq?" The second call came about 3 months later, by which time America had begun to withdraw its troops, and my grandmother was packing up to go home. This time, Sammy spoke only to our father, who, after hanging up, immediately took his jacket off the coat rack and went for a walk. When he got home, he went into my bedroom, where my grandmother's suitcase was three-quarters full and her boarding passes to London, Cairo, and Amman were propped up against my fishbowl of dice. He sat her down on my bed and took her hands in his. Then he told her that Ahmed, her husband of 57 years, had had an embolism that morning and died. "Mr. Jafari." I looked up to see her standing on the other side of the immigration desks, evidently refusing to complete the distance between us. "We'd like to ask you a few more questions. Do you want to come through?" We rode an escalator together down to the baggage claim, where Denise consulted the overhead monitors.
Then we walked the full length of the vast hall to locate my suitcase standing in solitude beside a stopped carousel.
Extending its handle, I tipped it onto its wheeling position and followed Denise most of the way back to the escalator, followed by a left into goods to declare. A male customs officer awaited us there, and while I hoisted my case onto a metal examination table, he snapped on a pair of purple rubber gloves.
"Pack the bag yourself?"
"Yes."
"Anybody help you pack?"
"No."
"Are you aware of all the contents of your bag?"
"Yes." While he poked around among my socks and underwear, Denise resumed her own questioning, thinly disguised as small talk.
"So, what's the temperature like in Iraq at this time of year?"
"Well, it depends on where you are, of course. In Sulaymaniyah, it should be pretty mild, like in the 50s.
"What's that?" Denise said to the customs officer. 10? 12?
"Got me."
"So when did you last see your brother?"
She opened my Iraqi passport again. "In January of 2005.
"In Iraq?"
"Yes."
"Is he an economist too?"
"No, he's a doctor."
The customs officer held up a package wrapped in pink and yellow gift paper.
"What's this?"
"An abacus," I said.
"An abacus, like for counting?"
"That's right."
"Why do you have an abacus?"
"It's a present for my niece."
"How old is your niece?"
asked Denise.
3.
"And you think she'd like an abacus?" the customs officer asked.
I shrugged. The customs officer and Denise both pondered my face for a moment, and then the officer began prying at a piece of tape. The paper underneath was thin, and as the tape peeled away, it took some of the color with it, leaving behind a white gash. Peering into the open end, the officer gave the package a little shake. We all could hear the wooden beads clacking together as they slid back and forth on their thin metal rods.
"An abacus," the customs officer repeated incredulously, before feebly attempting to rewrap it.
I followed Denise back up the escalator and down a narrow hallway into a room where she gestured toward a chair facing a desk. Sitting on the other side of the desk, she began jiggling a mouse. Several seconds passed, and then I asked whether, if this was going to take quite a bit longer, I might make a call.
"To Mr. Blunt?"
"Yes."
"We've already called him."
Eventually, Denise found what she was looking for and stood up to cross the room and jiggle another mouse attached to another computer. This monitor looked newer than the first and was rigged up to an elaborate array of auxiliary equipment, including a glowing glass slide and a camera that looked like a tiny cyclops. A photograph of my most neutral expression was taken, followed by my fingerprints, all digitally. In order to get a complete and acceptable set, Denise had to squeeze each of my fingers between her own forefinger and thumb and roll the tip over the glowing slide at least twice, sometimes 3 times. With one of my thumbs, 4. I did not find Denise attractive, nor was there anything suggestive to the way she manipulated my fingers, so it was a surprise when our prolonged physical contact began faintly to arouse me. Cooperating as we were, united by our desire to appease her hard-to-please computer with its red X's and supercilious little pings, gave me the feeling that we were merely playing border control, and that any moment now Denise's mother would call her in for supper and I would be freed. Instead, when the fingerprinting was done, we progressed to a second room, this one containing a small square table and 3 metal chairs. The upper half of one of the walls was composed of a dimmed glass in which my reflection was less a mirror image than a silhouette. Running horizontally under the glass was a long strip of red plastic, or rubber, like the tape you press on a bus to request a stop. A notice had been taped to the glass. "Please do not lean on the red strip as it sets off an alarm." Denise and I sat facing each other, my passport and her fat manila folder on the table between us. Then Denise thought better of this configuration and shuffled her chair around so that we were positioned at a right angle to each other instead. Sitting very erect, she opened her folder and took out a small stack of paper that she tapped vertically into alignment. Then she explained that she was going to ask me a series of questions, my answers to which she would write down and give me the opportunity to review. If I were happy with what she had written, I would sign my name at the bottom of each page, indicating my approval. I could see no fair alternative to this process, and yet, as it was explained to me, I began to have the sinking feeling you get when you agree to a game of tic-tac-toe, in which the other person gets to go first. For the next 20 minutes, Denise and I repeated, almost verbatim, the same conversation we'd had nearly 3 hours earlier, when I'd first reached the end of the metal maze. This iteration took longer, of course, because Denise had to write everything down in her loopy, schoolgirlish handwriting, and then, whenever she reached the end of a sheet of paper, there was the time it took for her to swivel it toward me and wait while I read it over and signed my assent. Naturally, answering questions I'd already answered felt like a waste of time, but soon enough I regretted my impatience, because when we finally did move on, it was into more sinister territory. Have you ever been arrested? No. Is Amar Ala Jafari the name you were given at birth? Yes. Have you ever used another name? No. Never? Never. You have never told a law enforcement officer that your name is anything other than Amar Ala Jafari? No. Denise studied me intently for a moment before writing this last note down. Can you tell me in more detail what you were doing here in 1998? I just graduated from college and had a year-long internship at the Toynbee Bioethics Council. I also volunteered at a hospital on weekends. What was your address during your stay? 39 Tavistock Place? I don't remember the flat number. And how was it that you came to live there? It was my aunt's apartment. Is it still? No. Why not? She died. I'm sorry. How? Cancer. The pen hovered. Pancreatic, I said. And now you're returning to London for the first time in 10 years. To see some friends. To meet up with Alistair Blunt, yes. For only 2 days. I looked at my watch. Yes. I'm just thinking, it's a long way to come for only 48 hours. Not even 48 hours. Well, like I said, I'm flying on to Istanbul on Sunday. It was the cheapest ticket I could find. What is your relationship to Mr. Blunt? We're friends. Do you have a girlfriend? A partner? No. No partner? Not at the moment. No. And no job? No. Denise smiled at me sadly. Well, I guess it's not a good time to be looking, is it? For a moment, I thought she meant for a girlfriend. Oh, I said airily. Something will come along. By the time she had run out of questions, our combined handwriting had filled nearly 13 pages. All right, Denise said brightly, standing and tugging her trouser thighs back into place. I'm just going to take you to our holding room while I make some general inquiries. Then what? Then I'll be discussing your case with the chief immigration officer on duty. When? I don't know. I'm sorry, I said. I know you're just doing your job, but could you please give me a sense of what you're discussing? What the problem is? There's no problem. We just need to check a few things. The background of your passports, that's all. As I've already explained to you, just some general inquiries. I looked at her. Are you hungry? No. Do you need to use the toilet? No, but I'm worried about my friend. I'm supposed to meet him in town in less than an hour. We've explained things to Mr. Blunt. He knows you're here. He knows we're just making some general inquiries. Initially, I had my eye on someone else. Then I went to see a performance of Three Sisters in which one of my roommates was playing Lieutenant Tusenbach and Maddie was playing Olga, and now I can't even remember the other girl's name. Like many Ivy League student productions, this one had an overwrought quality that gave you the impression the 20-year-old at the helm could now cross direct a play off his list of things to do before winning a Rhodes Scholarship. The night I attended, the girl playing Anfisa had taken a morning after pill at lunchtime, and at the moment of her entrance at the top of Act 3, was in the bathroom, retching into a toilet. Consequently, Maddie opened the act alone, accounting for both actresses' lines, the most crucial information being distilled into a riveting monologue premised upon A, Anfisa having been too tired to complete the walk from town, where B, a great fire was raging, traumatizing Olga such that she was hearing voices and talking to people who were not actually there. What if he is burnt? Cried Maddie, Olga, and Fisa. What an idea! All undressed, too! opening a closet and flinging clothes to the floor. "We must take this gray dress, Anfisa, and this one, and this blouse, too. Ugh, you're right, of course, you're right. Nanny, you can't carry them all. I'd better call Therapon."
By the time the imperious Natasha had come on, Maddie was huddled on a divan with a lace tablecloth over her head, trembling deliriously.
Anfisa? Natasha ventured. "What are you..." Twisting under her hood, Maddie threw Natasha a meaningful look. "Anfisa," said Natasha when the penny dropped. "Don't you dare to sit down in my presence." At which point Maddie stood, removed the improvised shawl from her head, and, playing Olga again, fixed her castmate with a withering stare. "Excuse me, Natasha, but how rude you were to Nanny just now." Well, I thought that was some of the best acting I'd ever seen. Were it not for the scandalized traditionalist whispering behind me, I would not have suspected anything amiss. That night, when Lieutenant Tuzenbach returned to our suite with a bit of pumpkin-colored makeup still collaring his neck, I learned that Madalena Monti had had her pick of semester's leading roles and was already hobnobbing with the seniors bound for graduate school in Los Angeles and New York. After that, like a word you come across for the first time and then it's everywhere, she began to appear in my path or periphery several times a week.
Reading in the dining hall, smoking a cigarette outside the language lab, legs outstretched in the library, roaring a silent yawn.
I thought she was beautiful in the way some girls are beautiful despite having bypassed pretty entirely. It was a fickle beauty, undermined in an instant by her sardonic mouth, or by her eyebrows arching to angles of cartoonish depravity. A moment later, these same features that made her an electrifying Olga, or Sonia, or Lady Macbeth, would rearrange themselves into the radiant symmetry of a Yelena, or Salome. At first, I was wary of this inconsistency, which was reflected in her moods. I suspected it was deliberate, calculated to manipulate and seduce, and worse, that Maddie possessed little awareness of the motives and consequences of her behavior. But in time, I came to think that, in fact, Maddie, more than anyone, suffered her tendencies toward the mercurial, and moreover that this was probably the reason she was attracted to me. I was an antidote to what she liked least about herself. And contrary to the impression that she was not cognizant of her psyche's causes and effects, she was capable of startlingly articulate admissions of self-awareness. When we'd been having lunch together every Friday for a month, I asked her why she wasn't closer to her roommates. "Oh, I'm not good with other women," Maddie replied simply. "They make me feel inessential." The night before Christmas break during our freshman year, she came to my room chewing on a thumb and consulting the calendar hanging on the back of my closet door. She was pregnant by a graduate student in the classics department, though I never did learn his name, nor how they wound up in bed. And someone at the campus health center had informed her that one must be at least 5 weeks along before a pregnancy may be terminated. December 30th, Maddie concluded, if she did not want to do it a day later than necessary. December 30th in 1994 fell on Isa al-Miraj, by which time I was back at home in Bay Ridge, getting dressed to go to the mosque. Maddie called from her mother's house outside Albany and confesses she had not been able to have it done after all. She was eager that I understand this was not owing to any late-breaking moral qualms. Undetected by her mother, she'd driven herself to Planned Parenthood downtown, registered, paid for the procedure up front and in cash, changed into a paper gown, submitted the requisite blood and urine samples, and laid down for a sonogram, then sat in a room with approximately half a dozen other women to wait. There had been a television on, and whatever they were watching was interrupted by a news report about what had just happened in Massachusetts. A man had taken a rifle to the Planned Parenthood in Brookline and shot and killed the receptionist there. Then he went up the street to a preterm clinic and shot and killed the receptionist there. "Where's Brookline?" the girl next to Maddie asked. "Far away," Maddie had reassured her. "There was no need to worry."
But then the clinic's telephone began to ring, and two policemen arrived to tell the women in the waiting room that they should all put their clothes back on and go home.
"And now I don't know if I can go back." "Maddie, do you want a baby?"
"No."
"Do you want to have a baby and give it up for adoption?"
"No."
I waited. "I know I need to do it," she said. "I just don't want to go alone." That night, I kneeled beside my father in the mosque and thought about what it would be like to accompany a girl I had not gotten pregnant to her abortion. There were children present, many more than usual, and as they listened with wide, darting eyes to the story of Muhammad and Gabriel ascending into the heavens, I felt at once flattered and perverse. Afterward, in the parking lot, I was introduced by my parents to the daughter of some Lebanese friends, a pretty girl with long glossy hair and black eyeliner drawn expertly around each intelligent eye. She was home from Princeton, where she was a junior majoring in evolutionary biology, and I suggested that we meet for coffee one afternoon before we each went back to school. But I never did call her. Maddie knocked on my door the following week wearing a skirt. "Was I supposed to dress up?" I asked. "Oh," Maddie said quietly. "No, I just thought it would make me feel better to look nice." We didn't say much after that. The cold felt so reproachful of our mission that when we came to a cheerful-looking coffee shop, I suggested we stop in for some hot drinks. Maddie declined, on the basis that her stomach was supposed to be empty, so I went in to buy something for myself, and we walked on. The clinic was not at all what I expected. Vaguely, I'd imagined something more, well, clinical. Maybe a modern cinder block affair. But instead, Maddie was going to have her abortion in a 3-story brick manor, whose gabled roof, multiple chimneys, and lawn running the length of the block looked altogether more like a Victorian asylum. I was not allowed inside with my hot chocolate, so to register, she went in alone. Standing by the door, I watched her walk to the receptionist's desk, where, with her hood up and her hands in her pockets, she looked like an Eskimo asking directions. Next to the receptionist's computer stood a miniature foil Christmas tree, strung with colored lights that blinked quickly, then slowly, then quadruple time, like a disco strobe. Then went dark for a long, suspenseful moment before the cycle started over again. Why was I there? I was 18. I had had intercourse with only 2 girls, each of them once, both times with a condom employed so successfully that we might have been shooting a video for educational purposes. Maybe for this reason, I felt faintly censorious of Maddie's condition. But then, of course, even the most conscientiously donned condom does not always stay on and or intact. At any rate, this was not about me. You could draw a circle around me and my morals, and another around Maddie and hers, and the two needn't have overlapped. I had no share in this embryo. I had not asked her to do this. Later, Maddie would be in her room and I in mine, catching up on some reading over a cup of noodle, having relinquished a few hours of my time, but nothing more. Anyway, would I mind so much if our circles overlapped? All at once, my morals, whatever they were, felt too antiquated, too abstract. I threw the rest of my drink away and went inside to tell the receptionist that I was there with Maddalena Monti, and how long did she think she would be. The receptionist said that it had been quiet, and Maddie had not had long to wait, but the anesthesiologist was running behind, so it'd probably be 3 hours at least. I sat down in the waiting room and picked up an old New Yorker. An unseen speaker softly played, "Obladi, Oblada." The only other person in the room was a woman knitting, of all things, a baby sweater. After watching her needles gently fencing for a while, I flipped through the magazine until I became distracted by an ad offering finest ruby red grapefruit from Florida's Indian River. Tree ripened, brimming with juice, orchard sweet, no sugar is needed. Satisfaction guaranteed. The receptionist's phone rang. "No, not here." "No? None of that matters here, honey. You can come here and it doesn't matter. Between 4 and 7, depending on how far along you are. You do the exam and ultrasound here. Do you live in the area? Okay. Talk to him, and why don't you guys call me together and we'll schedule an appointment for you to come in. Everything is confidential here, hon." "No. No. Monday through Saturday. Do you know his schedule enough to schedule an appointment now? Okay, but just don't... Uh-huh. You know what? Don't... If I were you, hon, don't bring him in. Forget about that, and you don't have to call us back. Just come in before 6:30, okay? My name is Michelle. Okay? Okay. Okay. Bye." Much later, when Maddie emerged, holding her coat, she looked smaller all over, though I couldn't imagine why she should have. "I'm starving," she said. We bought donuts in the coffee shop on the way back to Silliman, and when we got to my room, Maddie asked if I had anything to drink. On the mantelpiece, I found a bottle of Maduri that belonged to my roommate, who wasn't due to return until the following week. Maddie filled half a mug with the emerald syrup and drank, making a face. "What's it supposed to taste like?" she asked. I looked at the bottle. "Melon," I said. Honeydew, I guess. She took off her boots and lay down on my bed. I put a CD on and sat in the chair to flip through the Spring Course catalog. The CD was Chet Baker, and the first three tracks were deeply mellow. Depressing, really. So I was about to get up and look for something else when we were saved by what I think is the only upbeat song on the album. They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when Edison recorded sound. They all laughed at Wilbur and his brother when they said that man could fly. They told Marconi wireless was a phony. It's the same old cry. They laughed at me wanting you, said I was reaching for the moon. But oh, you came through. Now they'll have to change their tune. They all said we never could be happy. They laughed at us and how. But ho, 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 who's got the last laugh now?
I thought Maddie was asleep, but when the trumpet interval came around, she spoke without opening her eyes. Do you know who Bob Monkhouse is?
No, who's Bob Monkhouse?
A British comedian my dad likes. Still alive, I think. And he tells this joke that goes, when I was a kid, I told everyone I wanted to be a comedian when I grew up. And they laughed. Well, they're not laughing now. 2 years later, when Maddie told me she too wanted to become a doctor, I laughed. I laughed with the haughtiness of a ballet mistress informing a dwarf that she will never be a prima ballerina. But 24 hours later, Maddie was sitting across from her academic advisor, discussing the logistics of changing her major from theater studies to anthropology and applying to post-baccalaureate conversion courses at many of the same medical schools to which I had applied. My reaction to this was febrile indignation. And I suppose, I said, that next month you'll want to be an astronaut, or a Wimbledon champion, or a clarinetist with the New York Philharmonic. No, Maddie said quietly. I'll want to be a doctor.
I'll want to be a doctor because I've been reading William Carlos Williams, and I've decided his is an exemplary life.
Oh, I see, I said contemptuously, even though I hadn't ever read any William Carlos Williams. So, you're going to become an overrated poet as well. And in the middle of a downpour, Maddie left my room and we did not speak for 3 days. What I decided during this enforced period of reflection was that my girlfriend would make a truly terrible doctor. I did not doubt her intelligence, nor had I observed her to be unusually squeamish about pain or blood, but her being, the clamorous, dizzying way she inhabited the world, never on time, cardigan inside out, Amma, where are my glasses, my ID? Has anyone seen my keys? On a good day, the chaos was barely containable. But Maddie on stage was something else. Acting organized her. It sorted her out. Like a laned highway, it regulated her speeds and, for the most part, prevented her emotions from colliding. She was good at acting, but also, and this was the elegance of the fit, acting was good for her. It made sense of her. It made sense of us. Maddie was the artist. I was the empiricist.
Together, we had an impressive and mutually enriching range of humanities disciplines covered.
Or so I believed. And so it seemed to me a perverse and even ungrateful surge of whimsy that she should want to be something else, anything else, but especially something so workaday, so unglamorous. A doctor. Maddie. It seemed, if you will, not unlike a prima donna, wanting to become a dwarf. Undoubtedly, I felt this way in part because I did not want to become a doctor. And maybe Maddie figured this out, and perhaps even felt sorry for her poor boyfriend and his repressed condition, because she tactfully forgave me my tantrum and went about recalibrating her life's path with little regard for the cynical glances I dealt her along the way. Meanwhile, of the 8 medical schools contemplating my candidacy, only one said yes. Curiously, it was the one I most wanted to attend, yet after opening the deceptively thin envelope, I lay on my bed and stared at the ceiling for an hour and a half.
Then I walked to the Office of Career Services, feeling, I suppose, like a man slinking off to a strip club, even as his beautiful wife awaits him in lingerie at home.
Most of the application deadlines in the binder labeled Research Fellowships had already passed. Of those that hadn't, I narrowed the choice down to 2, an assistant position in a cancer lab in Seattle, and publications coordinator for a bioethics think tank in London. The latter was described as a 9-month post that came with free airfare and a stipend of £100 a week. I applied. 3 weeks later, a man unforgettably named Colin Kaepernick